Good morning, marketers, and welcome to the If You Market podcast brought to you by Mountaintop Data and Johto PR. We are the only podcast that markets the shit out of it. I'm Sky Cassidy, and today we'll be talking with Dave Fink of Postie about walled gardens versus owned marketing, or versus open marketing, or free marketing, or whatever you want to call it. We're going to be talking about walled gardens and what all that means for your marketing. Dave thinks he's the best kept secret in marketing. I'm going to have to, that'll get edited out.
So, yeah, I definitely do not feel I am.
Dave thinks the best kept secret in marketing is hiding where you least expect it, in your mailbox. Over a 20-year career, he's generated hundreds of millions of dollars in ad revenue, powered viral sensations like Dollar Shave Club, and helped launch celebrity startups for Jessica Simpson, Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen, and Kate Bosworth. Now, as a founder and CEO of Postie, he's out to reinvent direct mail marketing for a digital world. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, walled gardens, this is a topic that's come up in episode after episode recently, I think. Data privacy keeps coming up, and then walled gardens keeps inserting itself. I'm really happy to have an episode just dedicated to this. For the listeners, can you give just a quick explanation of what that means? What is a walled garden in marketing?
Sure. So there are marketing channels that anyone can reach directly. You think about buying display advertising, banners on websites, or email marketing or SMS, where you have a specific piece of technology that allows you to send emails or send text messages. No one owns that inbox or mailbox. That's the consumers, and you can reach them directly at any time. The walled gardens are platforms that a specific company owns. So the two biggest that make up the data point that I love and hate is Facebook and Google command 85 cents of every dollar spent in digital media. They're behemoths, and each of those companies are walled gardens. If you want to reach someone through Google AdWords, you have to go through Google's platform. Google is driving that engagement. They have the relationship with the consumer, and you by proxy can reach those consumers through their ad platforms. Similar on Facebook. Facebook owns the Facebook universe. And if you want to reach somebody on Facebook, there's one singular way to access those individuals, and that's through Facebook ads or by through social engagement on the Facebook platform.
Right. So it's basically you don't have the freedom. You don't have any control over the marketplace yourself.
That's exactly right. And that's a double-edged sword. There's a lot of good there. And then there's also some challenges that we have to figure out how to live with or overcome. From my perspective, the good is, in many respects, if you're new to digital advertising or a brand that's new to digital advertising, or you're launching a new brand, it's never been easier to get traction, right? There are two monster platforms that you could kind of put all of your initial early stage emphasis in learning how to optimize and scale, and again, that's search and social. And instead of having to go tackle a really complex omni-channel marketing strategy out of the gate to have some initial success and drive awareness, you can focus on those two channels. And that's a really powerful thing. And many brands that I've been involved with, and I'm sure that your listeners have been involved with, have had tremendous success, and they've built very big businesses. But at some point, for a number of reasons, which hopefully we can dive in here throughout this conversation, at some point there's either diminishing returns or it becomes much more challenging to continue growing your business just on those two platforms. And that's when I think that's the point that separates brands that are true truly transformative brands from those that eventually hit kind of that plateau in growth and scale.
So it seems like there's a handful of issues, but that's one I hadn't really considered before, is your scalability, because they want a piece of everything, You don't own the audience. It's their audience and you're kind of renting it, and they can raise, you know, they want a piece of everything and they want you to have just enough a piece to keep putting into it maybe, but they're going to keep raising it. And it's this competitive marketplace versus owning your own channel, owning your own audience type of a situation.
Yeah. And I think that's maybe one of the core trade-offs. And again, it's not all or nothing, right? You can be active on social and you can be active in search and still also, you know, breaking out of the walled gardens, which is what, you know, most big scalable lasting brands do. You know, I think the brilliance of those ad platforms and some of the dynamics that cause, you know, early day successes and more challenges with scale is that they're marketplaces. And, you know, if you rewind 20 years ago, the way that, you know, TV and print and out of home was sold was a volume game. The more that an advertiser, you know, committed and the bigger their ad buys, the better the pricing got. And so you could scale, you know, your marketing efforts and find more efficiency with that scale. The opposite holds true for these walled gardens, right? So, you know, you think about, you know, social, Facebook, namely, and, you know, Facebook and Instagram, you know, those are marketplaces where advertisers through, you know, the Facebook marketplace are bidding on ad impressions. And oftentimes, almost exclusively, the way that it works is in the early days when you can be very, very focused in a very specific, high, you know, yielding, highly engaged audience early in the early days of your Facebook ad spend, you're finding a tremendous amount of efficiency. And as you scale, you need to reach bigger and bigger segments and pools of prospect, you know, customers through those marketplaces. And you have more advertisers that are bidding on those same, you know, ad impressions. And so that drives up ad rates. And similarly, you know, Facebook in particular, Google as well, have done, you know, phenomenal job with the targeting capabilities that they give you as an advertiser. And what that means is you can, you know, do some really incredible things that allow you to harness efficiency in the early days. But again, as you scale, you know, those efficiencies do have diminishing returns.
You can max out their market. And I guess when I bring it up usually on this show, it's in a negative sense because I'm usually highlighting the negative aspects. But I mean, you said early on, there's a lot of really good things about it. It's nice to be able to go to the marketplace and sell your wares and sure somebody else takes a piece, but you may not own that market, but it's great to have all these places where, you know, like say it's for me to say, oh, these walled gardens, you don't own it, so you don't have control. At the same time, I would never say, oh, leave that out of your marketing. Maybe it shouldn't be your only marketing. You want to create your own owned marketing channels, but you want to diversify kind of, and they're great places to go sell stuff. You just can't put everything in them because they could be turned off on you at any time.
Well, that's exactly right. So you have all of the you know, benefits of amazing, you know, marketing and data tools, the sophisticated ad platform that you can continue to grow into as a brand, and all that early stage efficiency, again, you know, creates this platform to be able to launch brands, products, you know, really quickly and really efficiently. The piece that's missing with these walled gardens really is predictability. And in the early days of launching a brand, like we all have all had that experience where, you know, you have an interesting idea and you put effort into your initial, you know, product and you build out your website and you go to market, and within a day you're generating, you know, you're finding customers through those platforms, and that's amazing. As you grow as a business, especially if you take investment dollars from, you know, the venture community, or you're raising money from banks, and you have accountability, predictability in your growth trajectory matters a lot. And if you have a singular or a couple of fail points, you know, call it Facebook and Google, in your entire marketing stack, you know, that means that every morning you're waking up and you're nervous as a cat, wondering if Facebook's algorithm is going to change, or if you punch through the next, you know, potential target audience, you use the term saturation. So you saturated a specific segment that was, you know, converting really well for you into customers. And now all of a sudden, you know, you're stuck.
Or suddenly a competitor just got funding that you wasn't even on your radar. And now they are doubling the cost of all of your marketing in these channels.
Happens all the time. Could be a competitor, could be, could be another, you know, product or service that isn't even competitive, but is bidding against the same audiences that you've been against.
Right. Yeah. So you get this auction scenario where it's not just that you're competing against your competitors and people that have the same audience, maybe some the same keywords, but you're not competing like, are they going to buy up my product or their product? It's, are they going to even see my marketing or not? So it isn't they see both your marketing, and now it's all of a sudden, no, I'm just bid out of this keyword. There's a large player that just says, you know what? We just don't want anyone else to get in this space. We're just going to buy it out type of a thing. You don't have that control. Whereas a newsletter, direct mail, live in person, what are the non-walled garden channels?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's certainly certain mechanics and challenges in any given channel, but you know, it's anything outside of marketplaces. So I would put out of home, you know, billboards, trains. Yes, sure, someone owns that media, but they're you can reach them through any ad agency. There are a number of ways to buy that inventory. There's not one singular competitive marketplace to bid on that on those ads. Certainly direct mail, linear TV, radio. We'll see what happens with connected TV. I believe that those will become walled gardens, but there's enough of them, right? You have Hulu and Netflix and Comcast and Time Warner, each of those platforms, you know, maybe their own walled garden, but there'll be enough diversification to be able to move throughout them.
So as a key aspect here, not just that somebody creates this channel that they own, but the amount of competition for that type of channel. So if you have the only radio station, then you kind of have this walled garden, you control it. But the more competition there is for a similar channel, the less control you have. So Google AdWords has, I don't know if I assume Bing has some ads and search, you can pay to put search terms on it and stuff, but they kind of have the market so cornered that they are able to control it and thus act like a monopoly and really clamp down on and have so much more control over it.
They became behemoths. They have they have the majority of users, the majority of ad, addressable ad units are in those channels, are running through those platforms. I think as marketers, we all root for, if you think about social, right? You know, Facebook for a very long time was the only game in town. Now we're seeing, you know, Snap and TikTok, emerge. And so I think that's a good thing with some more, a similar type of, you know, engagement numbers and similar type of ad units. But
yeah. I bet you can get ads really cheap on MySpace.
I would think so. It's been a while since I bought, that's probably true. You probably go a little deeper and look at, you know, Friendster as well.
There are a lot of platforms out there that would be happy to have your ads. Yes. And then that gets into these platforms also early on. It's always very inexpensive because there's nobody else bidding. You're showing up at a party, nobody else is there. They're really happy to have you. Once it builds up, it's this whole, their popularity creates more popularity thing. Everybody has to be there now type of a situation.
Yeah. I think that's been the case with advertising. Pretty much always. There's never been a world like there is today where it's the power has been so centralized in a couple key ad platforms. Certainly, you know, the day of magazines, you know, those publications with bigger circulations and certain demographics became more powerful. Their ad rates were higher. Same thing with newspaper circulation, certainly, you know, TV shows and prime time and, you know, ad formats where you're buying in the upfront, et cetera. I think the difference was that that again, there just wasn't such a singular consolidated, place to reach that audience. And look, there's a reason why, when you look at Facebook and Google, they're two of the most successful companies in the history of the world. It's partly because of the utility that they're providing consumers, the social platform, the ability to access and search for and find the most relevant content on the web, in Google's case. And because of that, that utility and those engagement, levels, they can, then monetize those platforms. They became really savvy thinking about data and complex mathematics, and that feeds into targeting. And the bigger that you are as a company, and the more engagement you have, and the more revenue that you're generating, the more investment you can make in better tools. And that cycle just perpetuated itself over the last 15 years.
And it has gravity. It just keeps creating more, sucking more in, creating more gravity. Again, when was the last time anybody put an ad on Bing? Come on. It might do really well because maybe you're getting the audience that's there. You're really getting them and getting them at a low cost. But as a marketer, you're going to go where the audience is. And that gets then the own channel, where they are is always where they are. Their mailbox, their email box, their phone, those channels are these open channels. And I've seen this tendency over maybe the last 10 years even, but Google, let's use them as an example, see if we can get neither of us to ever rank again by talking about Google. So we've seen this tendency with Google, or I have. I've been seeing all these little signals that they seem to have themselves saturated their market, kind of. They have so much of the market that there's people within Google that have to be looking at it saying, where do we go next? How do we increase our profits? We have, like, they have diminishing returns. They have such a high percentage trying to get that last couple percent. So they need to look elsewhere. What part of the market don't we have? Oh, there's this huge chunk of marketing we don't touch with all these owned channels that we don't own. And I've spoke about it a couple times, but I've seen Google specifically attacking email because they see that as, here's this channel. If we can own email somehow, and you don't have to, email's an open channel. It'd be near impossible to get rid of email, but you can demonize email. And what they did a while back, what they played with a while back, was trying to own email validity. Basically, they wanted to let companies put a little icon, a little logo on their email. And in that way for them, they said, oh, then you know this is a trusted, this is a real email. It's all about safety, right? Oh, this is the spam is the big, and that's what they use to try to attack the email market. And maybe, I want to know if you've seen something similar in the physical mail marketplace, but they see email as this huge area, a lot goes on in email that they don't make money off of. If they can get people to not trust the open email market, then, and you only trust them, now suddenly they own it. So they wanted to add this icon to the emails. Companies have to go through them to get it, kind of like getting a DUNS number or something like that. And then, with DMB owning DUNS numbers, massive, massive win for them. So they wanted to create a similar thing with emails. And what it means then is, if you don't have a Google verified email account, which you're going to need to pay them for, probably not initially, but eventually they're going to monetize this. If you don't have that, then your emails aren't trusted. Nobody's going to look at them. So that it's a safety thing. It's a, hey, it'd be really cool if you got your company logo here. But ultimately what they're looking to do is undermine the open channel of email and make you have to go through Google for it.
Well, I'm not going to claim that that's something I've spent a ton of time thinking about and researching, so I wouldn't consider myself an expert there. But as a user, Google's done an unbelievable job of integrating utilities into every second of my day. So this morning I was out driving through town and wasn't certain where I was going, and what do? I pull up my GPS, and what GPS do I pull up? I pull up Google. And then when it's time to search for a place to grab a breakfast burrito, guess what? They've native integrated search, right? Within Within Google Maps, which by the way, I'm not even using my phone for because I'm running it through Apple CarPlay, and next thing I know, I basically am thinking about a breakfast burrito on the way home from, you know, wherever I was going. And there's revenue generated for Google. I think the same thing's true with email, right? We have email coming at us on our laptops, on our desktops, on our phones, on our watches, et cetera. And Google's done a great job of, one, catering to the user, right? So things like building better and better algorithms to fight spam. They certainly are, even without that verified icon that you were talking about earlier. They're kind of policing, what mail gets to my inbox and what doesn't. They give me the opportunity to set up promotions, inbox and social inboxes. That's a lot of power. That's a lot of control. And they're certainly, capturing the data on every email I receive and every email I respond to. And I'm sure there's a wealth of other data that they're using from my use of email apps. And look, that's just, I think their goal has always been, how does that walled garden expand so that they're interjecting themselves in every kind of daily interaction they can think about, or that we think about as consumers, and that's a really powerful thing, and it's a trade that we as modern day consumers have been willing to accept, right, in exchange of sharing, data on our whereabouts and our messaging, communication, and contact lists, and what's in our home, and our product purchases, and our research and searching, et cetera, in exchange for these great utilities. It's 2021.
So you guys, Postie, you guys are in the physical mail space, right? That's your
focus. That's correct.
So can you tell the listeners real quick? I guess we're just going to jump straight through. I don't think we're going to even take a break today, to what you guys do as a company, because that's kind of my last question / next question. I want to know if you've seen any of the walled garden channels looking to encroach in that space, kind of to either minimize it, to undermine it, or to try to take over. I mean, you do have FedEx and that kind of stuff. So you have private mail, but I'm sure some of these channels would love to get rid of the, government open. You can for 60 cents or whatever a stamp is, I don't even know, you can send a message across the country, or a postcard, a business postcard, for even less. Tell the audience a little bit about what you guys do there at Postie for me.
Sure. And I can tackle a couple of those questions. So Postie came about 6 years ago as a reaction to kind of the reaching saturation levels within these walled gardens that we had built lots of business, consumer brands on. And the idea was, we love the mechanics of quantitative marketing and the amazing tools and targeting and optimization capabilities available on search and social and programmatic. We just need other channels that we have more control of and that can add more predictability into our growth and help us manage our own business's P&Ls a little bit better, without that nervous stomach that comes from solely relying on search and social. And the reason that we turned to direct mail was this idea of scale matters, right? We don't want to be spending a ton of time and energy into channels that might be effective, but that don't have a lot of scale. You referenced, some of the secondary and tertiary search engines. Sure, you probably could find some efficiency there.
Once you max out Google AdWords, then you go over. No, yeah, you go.
It's
to
a lot of effort for a little return, but. The kind of a unthought of little secret about direct mail or mail in general is that it's 20% bigger than Facebook. It's 20% bigger than Google. Like the majority of people are engaged on those platforms on a daily basis, but not all. But anyone with a physical address is reachable through the postal stream. Two, to some extent, there's a bit of some walls in that the way that you get into people's mailboxes is relying on delivery and logistics through the U.S. Postal Service, but it's a government utility.
Right. And so, they may raise the cost of a stamp a little bit and you have a print house, but there's so much it's either a government utility or there's so much competition with print houses and stuff that nobody can control the market.
Correct. And the way that I would think about it is that it's a public right to put a stamp on something and communicate with someone through the mail. No, they can't block it. Sure, there are costs that could move up and down.
Government sanctioned physical spam.
Hey, that's not what we see. We see markers with you know, brilliant storytelling and messaging, communicating in meaningful ways to, you know, very targeted audiences.
I joke because my business is mostly in the email space. We sell data, but email is the biggest part of that. People still use it for phones and physical mail and social as well. But I see, you know, an unsolicited email as the same thing really as an unsolicited print mail. It just doesn't cost as much. So people tend to get out of control or have in the past with the spamming of it versus the physical mail. You're like, well, if I got to pay for this thing to be shipped, I'm going to be a little more discerning.
That's correct. You're going to be thoughtful about it. You're going to care about the return on that investment that you're making in the channel. To answer your question on what Postie is, when we fell in love with the channel, the potential power, reach, scale, kind of the next step was looking at, is there targeting capabilities that could rival, the benefit that we get from digital channels? And we very quickly found out that unquestionably there's amazing targeting capabilities in the channel. And there's also a number of really clean methodologies for direct measurement, understanding whether your ad campaigns, your communication are resonating with your audiences and what the return on that investment is. So those three things got us really excited about the channel, and in many ways looked very similar to all the digital channels that we had grown up with. What looked very different was that when we set out to execute some campaigns, we learned that there really hadn't been any technology, investment in this channel in many, many years. And the manual way that you execute a direct mail campaign today, outside of Postie, for the most part, is no different than the way it was 20 years ago. It's labor intensive, long lead times, very manual and analog. And that part just wasn't really acceptable to us and our marketing teams. And so Postie set out to build the technology layer that ports all of the kind of value and automation capabilities to launch, scale, optimize that channel to the direct mail space. And so this same kind of collection of tools and capabilities that your marketing team is engaging with Facebook or Google or programmatic or retargeting, they now can access and leverage to manage their direct mail campaigns. So that was the way that we think about the value that Postie brings to the direct mail space.
The last upgrade in technology I saw in the direct mail space was in trying to scale personalization or fake personalization with the machines where you'd write something and then it would basically copy that 10,000 times and fold the letter so that you could have these machine handwritten setups to write the personal message, which wasn't. And I was like, well, that's not really that's more of a trick than you're scaling fake personalization. It was the next step up from when they first decided to start printing the signature in a different ink to look like a signature. And you look at it and you're like, now I'm insulted that you're trying to fool me with this. Can you just give me your message? So what is it that you guys are doing with physical mail that's different or new or effective for the user?
Yeah, well, so first of all, Kenneth, I think what you're referencing is more the operational side of direct mail, the actual kind of physical ads, the what you can do with ink and paper.
And I started praying, God, I hope that's not what you guys do now that I just shit on it.
No, those are all tactics. And the truth is any one tactic is a tactic and no different than a tactic or a creative that you may run on Instagram or a headline you might run on a Google ad. Any specific ad comes and goes and those are all tactics.
Right.
What we think about is how do we make it easy and fast to take an idea from your head as a marketer and get it into the real world fast so that you can affect your business's growth trajectory very, very quickly. Historically, I think If you wanted to all of a sudden, you know, execute a direct mail campaign with from an idea that you had today, you're probably planning 60 days in advance with most traditional direct mail method executional methodologies. With Postie, you literally could be designing and uploading creative into your Postie account, building audiences and going into production tomorrow and being in home next week. Is kind of the utility at its most simplified view. From there, it then becomes, once you have this layer to be able to move quickly from an executional perspective, now it's how do you enable testing and optimization? How do you start helping advertisers understand what messaging and what ad formats are most effective for their business? How do you start giving them complex segmentation capabilities to start thinking about instead of, one size fits all, I have the bandwidth to create one creative or one A/B test and that's what I'm going to put into the world across all audience segments. Why don't we think about optimizing direct mail campaigns at a very nuanced level the way we do our Facebook campaigns. So our advertisers are using the Postie platform to build, in some cases, thousands of different campaign segments with, hundreds of different creatives that historically just wouldn't have been possible to execute on. But with a software layer, all of it is executionally possible, but also just as simple as any of the digital programmatic channels. And then lastly, really is targeting and measurement. So accessing the same quality capabilities to build lookalike models, leveraging your brand's first party data insights on their customers or insights that they can learn about their customers from the Postie platform and turn those into, again, predictive models or optimized campaign segments. And finally is the measurement side. So instead of waiting 30 days or 60 days after a campaign deployed and kind of manually figuring out what worked and what didn't, probably not super cleanly, the Postie platform integrates directly with your backend databases and CRMs and is able to help you very cleanly in real time understand exactly what's going on with your ads and your prospect or your customers' response rates.
So you're managing them almost like somebody would manage their Google AdWords. You're just like, oh, I've got this ad and that ad, and let's push this one out now, and let's put this one to this segment, and I can see my details. And
that's right. All that kind of stuff. That's right.
Except for you don't own the channel like they do. It's still an open channel.
It's an open channel. There are many ways you can run direct mail. We're just trying to give you a more modern way to do it so that you can get to market faster, learn faster, and get a positive return on your ad spend faster and turn this channel into a meaningful complement to the rest of your marketing stack.
Awesome. Okay. Do you guys work with a lot of account-based marketing? It seems like this is kind of a natural fit for.
So it's a great question. Interesting. We don't. So most of what we do is.
I don't believe you. You just don't know it. But people are using you with their account-based marketing, I bet.
They may be. We spend a lot of time focused on complex mathematics and machine learning on top of big consumer data sets. And so more of the brands that are on the Postie platform are brands that are engaging directly with consumers versus B2B. In the B2B world, I know. In the
B2B now you world, tell me.
Doesn't mean I can't help you.
I know, I'm just kidding. Can't help you.
But that's certainly our core competency, and data is such a key component of what we do. And as you know, the availability of data and what you can do with modern mathematics and machine learning and that data, those big data sets in the consumer world is much deeper.
There's so many more data points to know about somebody. Like somebody's work personality does not have as many points of interest as their personal life. Like the B2B data, typically whether they have a dog or a cat, what type of dog and cat, how many, the age of the animals, whether they have children, that all these details, what foods they don't really come into play in the B2B marketplace. So yeah, we just have so many less data points to work with. And in the consumer world, those data points are all been collected for a long time now.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Let's get to you real quick. I can see what your company does. we got the walled garden thing. I mean, we're going to get back to the walled garden thing a little bit here, but I do want to touch on you real quick, kind of how you got to be where you're at and your path through to Posty, as much as you want to tell people.
Sure. No, I love my path. It was very, I think, authentic and organic and took a while. And I think I was not one of these natural whiz kids that just came out of, you know, high school or college and knew how to start a business and launch a business and you know, found tremendous success out of the gate. That certainly wasn't my path. I kind of fell into consumer internet I think I was probably 21 years old, a year or two removed from college. And back then it was web 1.0. And I worked for a marketing technology company in sales. And
let's say your last non-founder role was like 2008. So I don't know.
It's been a while, but there are plenty of challenging, you know, stops, since 2008 for sure. But yeah, really what got me here to an entrepreneur is that as an ad, you know, salesperson, I was engaging with the broadest set of advertisers, and I was working with the big CPG brands and biggest omnichannel retailers, or then they were pretty much just retailers, 2000, 1999, something like that. And those sales cycles, I think, were fairly boring in many ways. You were dealing with really structured procurement conversations and lots of like, it's just lots of structure. And then I also got to spend my time selling into startups. And I remember selling into startups where I was in a room with the founder. I was a 21, 22 year old, you know, kid selling, you know, selling my product. And there was a founder and a CMO, typically working in a crummy office space without windows and card tables. And we would do business together, and I'd come back 6 months later and they'd be in a bigger office with, you know, maybe real desks. And then
you were like, I want to be you when I grow up, but you're younger than me. So this is confusing.
Well, there was, back then I was about the same age, yeah. But it was, you know, I saw these trajectories and then you like show up 2 years later, there'd be like a bunch of Ferraris in the parking lot and they'd be in fancy offices and there'd be 400 people at these companies. And it was mind blowing to me that someone could just create something from nothing and within a few years be doing, you know, something transformative in their industry.
So you were inside a walled garden and you were like, I want to own my channel. You were in another company and you were like, I'm controlled by what I can do and what I can.
I like that analogy. To me, it was just the idea of creating something that any human was capable of coming up with an idea, and through hard work, certainly a little bit of luck, some skill development, you know, could create something. And so I knew very, very early on that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I was one of these people that needed to go develop a bunch of skills, get beaten up a bunch in the market, learn from smart people. And early on, I think the one thing I did right was just I constantly glammed onto the smartest people, smartest entrepreneurs that I could find, and became friends with them and asked lots of questions and made sure I was doing, you know, learning about their business and being helpful any way that I could. And look, I'm a few years older than 22 now. and I'm, you know, now maybe feel comfortable as an entrepreneur instead of someone that needs to learn how to be one.
So one of the things that I hear as a takeaway from that is, as a company, don't put your young talent, don't let them work directly with startups, because they are going to get the bug and they're going to go start their own thing. Like, if you really want to keep somebody, maybe don't let them work directly with the startup. It's too tempting for the talented, smart people on your team.
Well, I do appreciate that. Before the record, I did spend 7 years at that company. So
you gave them their due. Yeah.
I think I generated quite a bit of revenue for them and growth, and certainly it was a very fair trade, but look, I think a lot about, you know, my own internal development and then my team's development, from the most entry level employee up to our C-suite. And I think you just generally gotta keep people challenged, and that's like probably the greatest gift that you can give someone, is keep them interested, add value to their life beyond just, you know, their daily responsibility set. And I think if you do that, regardless on what their path is, they're going to add value to the ecosystem and you'll get some value from your own business. But I think it all, yeah, what goes around comes around. I really do.
It's a hot topic today, the retaining employees. So I guess I'd also say trying to lock your employees down and get them to never leave should not be the goal. If you have Dave Fink for 7 years and he brings a lot to your company and then he moves on, great. You look at, coaches in professional sports, they have a lot of coaches under them. They rarely try to prevent them from going anywhere. They're going to hopefully grow out and you grow new people. So as a company, a lot of your best people may move on, but they move on as part of your legacy. And you should be able to, if you can't grow another one, then you just got lucky with Dave. That your problem isn't locking him down.
Certainly. We haven't lost too many people at Postie. Those that we have typically have gone to very different opportunities and there's just a different career stop on their career path that they wanted to tackle. I miss those people. I still think about them, right? They were people that that we invested in, that added value to us, that were part of the Postie family, and really happy for them. And the truth is I'd take them back in a heartbeat if they, if there was the right role for them. And I felt that this was a good opportunity for them. I think the number one thing that you can do as a boss in general is look at the people that work for you or with you, not as employees, but just as people.
Yeah. Don't turn your company into a walled garden, trying to imprison your employees. Although a lot of the employees we've lost in the past, I think about it now and it wouldn't happen because of remote working. We lost them to moving type situations versus,
sure.
versus other things. And with remote work, it's a lot easier to retain employees as long as you don't suck as a company. So I know this is we've shifted the, I always tell people, look, if your employees are leaving for another dollar an hour, then it's not the dollar that they're leaving for. They don't like working for you. Like they'll stay for a dollar less if they like where they're working. So we're off on a completely different topic, but I'll try to analogize it to the walled garden still.
Yeah, look, I mean, I spend more of my time today as a CEO of a business that's scaling, thinking about long-term vision, people, and in theory, productivity, but it's more, I really do spend a lot of time thinking about the satisfaction of the people that are working with us, for us, our partners, our customers. And to be quite honest, I think that the general perspective of a good company, and it certainly gets more complicated over time, but I think if you take the perspective that hopefully you're starting with some kind of mission, and that doesn't mean you're out necessarily trying to solve the biggest problems in the world, but hopefully you've started a business, a company, launched a product because there was some pain point that you recognized, you had some unique perspective to help solve. And if you hold on to that mission, you can surround yourself with other team members and colleagues who understand that mission, are bought into that mission, and are excited about trying to help solve find a solution to that problem and carry out that mission. I think generally there's a much higher level of satisfaction than if it's just an opportunistic role or an opportunistic company. And there are certainly lots of valuable companies that were built on pure, again, opportunity, meaning they understood a business model and there's a way to make some money in a specific segment of the world. But the businesses I think that tend to do, have lasting effect are those businesses that do have some purpose or mission. And they tend to hire,
Oh my God, we're doing employee retention now. We're gonna go start getting into all why. And these are all hot topics for me. So I don't wanna start digging into those things. We don't have time to address all of that. But let's refocus back to the walled garden to finish it off here. I think there's a couple great takeaways here. One that yes, they're not owned channels, but they're still great channels to be in for your marketing, especially early on, because you don't have to create all this. You don't have as much, really early on, a company doesn't have as much uncertainty. You know, you can say, oh, there's the uncertainty. You don't know if it's going to be there, but you know, it's going to be there a hell of a lot more than your own marketing, because you don't own anything yet. You can create a product, focus on that, and then just put up a Google AdWord to an audience and know it's going to get to that audience. Put up a Facebook ad, know it's going to get to that audience. So that is a really nice aspect of these kind of curated crowds.
I'm 100% with you. And quite frankly, like most businesses, not all, but most businesses should start on those easy to launch channels where you can learn fast, you can iterate fast, and you can quickly, you know, figure out how to engage with your audience. There's no world we can get into the potential like good versus evil and corporate America and things like that. And there are some real questions out there in some of these companies, but with regards to the ad platforms themselves, like I think that if you're a smart marketer if you're savvy, the best place to go is the place where you can learn the fastest and drive most advantage. And for sure, those walled gardens, as painful as they get at scale, are really powerful places to start. And
the first thing I put down was ease. You're paying more, you have less control, but the ease part allows you to quickly get in and quickly move. And one of the biggest downsides you mentioned was the scalability. At some point you max out on your ROI. Great. That means you've maxed out on your ROI. So you start creating your own channels. You start getting more into your own marketing. But yeah, there's a lot of room when you start from nothing, usually within those channels.
That's right. And it's the same, I think, just in startups in general, it's fail fast. And a startup can be a true startup, or a startup could be a new product within a bigger company. Figure out the fastest way to succeed or the fastest way to fail. And then when you find some success in some of those easy channels, don't rest on your laurels. That's the time to start leaning into other channels and remembering that there's a ceiling in every channel.
You can fail for $10 a day on Google AdWords before you even make your product. Like sure. That's pretty nice versus going out and doing a physical mail campaign or buying an email list and setting all that up and sending campaigns or starting cold calling. It's like, hey, you can just throw up a Google ad just to see if people are into this or not.
Yeah. You can create a Google AdWords account today and load in some text-based creative and be up and running in a few hours.
Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing, right? And again, there's no world in where I would say, yeah, you shouldn't be playing in social and you shouldn't be playing in search.
Let's bring this around to Posty. You guys make it so people can do a very similar thing with physical mail now.
That's right. That's exactly right. So from a, you know, highly encourage brands, as soon as they start gaining some traction in one of these other channels, that's time to take those learnings and start thinking about the other channels that they can, that they have the resources to be able to test into. It's you got to be omnichannel. The sooner that you get there, the better. Remember, it's not just about building a brand on Facebook or on Google. It's about building a brand. It's about building a customer base. It's about building a company. And you know, historically, if you'd asked me before Posty, I probably would not have said direct mail is the next channel to jump into. But what I've seen,
it was old and dead, and that made it great because people weren't using it as much. So sure. People look, start paying attention.
It was always an amazing channel, but the executional components, the ability to tap into the same quality data, find success quick and fast and scale rapidly once you find success, like that capability didn't exist. With Posty, it does. So unquestionably, you know, you get your Facebook turned on, you get your Google turned on, you start getting some traction, you understand generally what messaging is working, you get your website and your kind of your owned and operated channels, mainly email working or retargeting. And I would highly encourage you to start poking around in direct mail. It is a phenomenal channel to move to next.
So the last thing to touch on here is I want you to put on your, well, I guess that's not a hat. I want to get out your crystal ball and think about what do we think the future is going to look like in these marketing spaces. We've gone from the ancient times of there's the marketplace, you have the public marketplace, and maybe if you're not in that marketplace, then you're in random streets, but people are selling their wares in the marketplace. At some point, somebody comes in and probably owns it, and it's no longer a public marketplace. And now you have this walled garden marketplace that's owned, and there's not many places. And then eventually physical mail is invented, and people actually have addresses where you can send something. And then we get the invention of the telephone, and then we get the invention of the email. Physical mail still there, the public marketplace. I mean, we still have live events, and we still have consumer, we still have the shopping mall and stuff like that. But what do you think we can expect to have next in when it comes to marketplaces? What's going to happen? Are the walled gardens going to continue to expand and envelop everything? Are we going to have a constant back and forth? What do you see?
For many years, my belief has been there's a world where the walled gardens do lose their power and maybe even disappear. And I think that the reason I think about that is I think there could be a world where there's hardware. And then there's personally identifiable kind of information, ways that you represent yourself on those platforms and connect. And then maybe a series of more micro level utilities. So take
you said the walled gardens with this. So like Google AdWords, you think could disappear? I mean, would that have to be due to competition? How else could that go away? Would
the government break it up? Social. Let's start with social, because I'm a little less certain about search. Because at the end of the day, the internet has democratized content distribution. There's so much content, so the utility of helping make sense of how to access relevant content.
The government could break Google up into a search engine and ad company.
Sure. And look, there's certainly that is a reasonable topic. But let's talk social, right? So social is a platform where you share kind of your whereabouts, you communicate through video chat or proxy to phone chat. Where you share photographs, images, and your own videos, to some extent, I just look at it and say, like, well, if I have a phone and I have a phone number, like, what do I need a social app for? I have all my photos. Like, why can't it be easy to just share?
I do love when people won't text. They want to I don't go on Facebook very often, and they want a Facebook message. And I'm like, you have my phone number. I have this thing called text. You can send me a message.
Yeah. Right. I think that it's possible that there's just an oversaturation of kind of the showing off that happens on social, right? You hop on Instagram and it's everybody's like best event of the day. And it's just a constant reminder that like, oh my gosh, everybody's life is so amazing and full of fanfare.
Are you saying it'll become like a toxic enough atmosphere that enough people leave the party and then it kind of just falls apart without the mass?
I think that could happen. And then you look for more real personalized ways to interact. Mm-hmm. And so you want to share an authentic, image or article, et cetera. You're on a group chat with Thread through your iPhone or your Android phone.
I'm almost seeing a separation. You'll still have people on these channels. They're just the super thirsty people. And then you'll have people who, when they want to connect, they just connect. I think there's a Black Mirror episode about this.
Look, I think it could happen. I'm not necessarily predicting it. You asked for kind of a crystal ball.
Oh yeah. No. This is what I'm looking for. What's the crazy scenario that could happen other than the likely kind of drudge forward thing?
Yeah. I think that there could be, I'm optimistic that the typical individual will take more control over the way they communicate and what they put out into the world, and certainly in through the social webs that exist, and not necessarily have to rely on walled gardens algorithm to determine what image they see and what image they show. They want a group of individuals to see a specific piece of content. There's a direct path to do that, and I could see that happening. It's certainly not the path we're on right now.
Well, also half the time now you post something on let's say Facebook, I think, and half your friends don't even see it because they're throttling down, who can see what without, you know, what's your exposure. They don't want your natural exposure to be too high because you don't pay for natural exposure.
Yeah, sure.
Eventually we'll get sick of it.
Yeah, if you're a brand, but even if you're a consumer, right, there's no guarantee that everything that you post.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I could probably post my how I'm feeling today and half the people I'm connected with wouldn't even get it in their feed because that's, you know, that they're trying to throttle the natural exposure. Whereas when they started, everyone that had an account would see everyone's everything every time because there wasn't that many people at the party. Once you get a lot of people, kind of they're crazy. Like, now we got to control them.
Yeah, it's kind of a crazy thought to think that, like, if you're getting the majority of your news cycles from shares that your friends are making on a social platform, that company's algorithm gets to determine what news you see.
And which friends' news posts you even see.
That's right.
It's like, oh, this friend has an opinion that you seem to have not connected with, clicked on in the past, so we're not even going to show you their their posts anymore.
It's a little crazy, right? You used to be that you know, certainly it was broadcast TV a while ago and you got to choose which, you know, local newscaster you related.
Which of the three channels you got to watch, yeah.
That's right. And then it was cable, right? And there's a bunch more. And then there were the, you know, kind of party specific channels that emerged and you could choose like where, like what angle you wanted and bounce back and forth if you were a bit more open-minded or whatnot. But you were making that decision, right?
Yeah. Like, we're getting into another hour-long topic here. we're dusting on a handful of topics. Anyway, speaking of which, we've hit, I think we've done about all we can do on this, the topic of walled gardens versus, let's say, free channels, as in freedom, not as in they don't cost anything, of course, but fully owned and you have to maintain and manage them type channels, I guess. So pluses and minuses on both sides for all these things, but understanding kind of what you're getting into with these walled garden. And hey, everybody likes a garden, everybody likes walls, no problem. Walled garden, just know the pluses and minuses of it. Dave, any last nuggets of wisdom to share with the audience here?
It really just, certainly as it, you know, revolves around this topic, it's just be mindful, right? Think about ways to make conscious decisions on where you're going to spend your time, your resources, your budget, and have an action plan. That doesn't mean that you're going to deliver those channels or those strategies or tactics are going to deliver, you know, every single time exactly as planned, but you know, be in control. You want to get up each day and know what you're looking to execute. And you want to have a way to measure and judge what's working and what's not working, and you just want to make sure that again that you are in control versus just kind of going along with momentum.
I'd say you know, if you like Google AdWords and Facebook, check out Posty. They have a public garden that you can come and have a lot of the same experience in.
Love it.
All right. Well, you can find more about this episode on ifyoumarket.com. We'll have the show notes there, more information on Dave Fink and on Posty there. Please share us. Please share the show on social media. I don't know, like and review and all that kind of good stuff. And on behalf of the If You Market team and Dave Fink of Posty, thank you for listening to the If You Market podcast, where we believe if you market the shit out of it with owned marketing, or walled gardens, I guess the episode isn't all about how bad they are, they will come. Are you looking for new leads or always in need of quality contacts for your marketing campaigns? But list companies and online tools are the worst, right? Well, then you've got to check out Top Data Search by Mountaintop Data. At Mountaintop Data, we're a team of weird people that actually like getting our hands dirty with sales and marketing data, and we specialize in business contact information. We compile and maintain a database of tens of millions of targeted high-quality business decision makers with emails, phone numbers, mailing address, and all the information you need. Go to topdatasearch.com and request a free account with the promo code IYM1000, like If You Market, the podcast here, and get a free account with unlimited searches, no seat fees, and 1,000 free record download credits. That's topdatasearch.com.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.